This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Suzanne Ceresco. She's a field worker for Doctors Without Borders, and she will be here tonight from 6 to 8 speaking at the Center for Contemporary Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here in Santa Fe.
It's really great to have you here in Santa Fe. Now, you have been working in many countries, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Malawi, so many different places all over the world. First of all, what does Doctors Without Borders do?
Sure. So Doctors Without Borders is an emergency medical organization that was founded in 1971 with the principle and the mission that they can speak out when they see obstacles to care. So the mission remains very much the same, but currently we've really grown and we're working in nearly 70 countries around the world doing all kinds of different medical operations and emergency work.
So is it always emergency, or like once you get into a country, do you then establish programs there?
Well, there are a lot of ways to define an emergency. So that's something that's often discussed within our organization and other places as well. So there are the emergencies that you see on the news, so the typhoon in the Philippines or the tsunamis. And then there are also emergencies related to conflict, population displacements. Of course, we can talk
refugee
about
refugee crises.
Yes, Syria, the historic levels of people on the move. And then there are other emergencies that are maybe low level or chronic. For example, last year we started a program in women's health in Manila, the capital of the Philippines, that's addressing access to women's health care. And we're going to be working in clinics in one of the largest slums in Manila. So we define an emergency as people who don't have access to health care.
So the Philippines was an interesting example because you went there for one of those big in the news emergencies.
Yeah, Typhoon Haiyan.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then ended up kind of seeing what the needs were, and lack of women's health care is its own kind of an emergency. What were you seeing that prompted you to start that program on a more long-term basis in Manila?
We did an assessment in the slum of Tondo, and we actually were put in touch with another organization that was working in the slum called Likan, and Likan had clinics, but they weren't able to provide all the services that they needed. So together with them, we started making a lot of different home visits and seeing what the conditions were and talking to women and understanding how they didn't have enough access to family planning, that they wanted better access to places for safe childbirth. And then the other issue that was coming up as well is access to HPV vaccine. And we just went from there. So we're going to provide comprehensive women's health care in two clinics there.
How did you get into this work?
I went to a recruiting session for Doctors Without Borders. I'd followed them in the news and thought they were an amazing organization. And I wanted to be involved, but since I'm not a medical person, I didn't think that there was necessarily a place for me. But then I saw this posting for the recruiting session and that they take people of all different backgrounds. So at the recruiting session, I let the recruiter know that I worked in the film business for 10 years. So I'd done production managing, done some work on location. And when I said that, that was really interesting to them because it's similar to the work that they do. It doesn't necessarily seem like it's analogous, but it is because they need a lot of people to do logistics, which is supply.
Yeah.
Supply.
Basically, you're doing a big production.
Yeah. Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's very similar. Supply, transportation, security, moving goods in, moving people, and a lot of coordination on the ground. So we do a lot so that things are organized, and we enable the medical team to be able to see patients. And so they can just concentrate on getting their work done. We're doing all the support services.
What was the first country that you went to?
Ethiopia.
And what was that like?
Oh, I worked in Ethiopia three times now. So the first time that I did it was in a very remote region in the south. It was in the mountains, so it was cold. It was my first time in Africa. And it was unlike anything I'd experienced to live in this village for 6 months. It was really fascinating, and we had a huge job to do. It was a malnutrition emergency, and a lot of people in need. We had children particularly affected in this crisis who were very vulnerable, so we set up two kinds of treatment centers. We did an outpatient program, which ended up having thousands of families in it every week to provide supportive food and treatment. And then we also had an inpatient program for children who were quite sick.
And so what had led to that emergency? What were the conditions that gave rise to you guys going?
So we had a team that was working in Ethiopia, and word had spread about the food crisis. So what we do before we open a project is we deploy a team to do what we call an EXPLO, which is an exploration. In fact, it's a rapid health assessment. So we had a nurse and a doctor who had gone to these different areas and spoken to the local authorities, spoken to the local health workers, gone into the clinics, and found out what the conditions were, and they confirmed that it was an emergency and that we needed to launch a response.
So, but I mean, what was behind the problem in the first place?
Sure. So there was a drought that year in Ethiopia, and the drought was then followed by very heavy rains. So there was a huge food shortfall. And yeah.
And so when you were there, I mean, I would think that that kind of work would be, both for doctors and for everybody else working in an organization like yours, just heart-wrenching on a daily basis. I mean, what were you seeing?
Oh, it really was tough to see children and people in so much need. And
like starvation, illness?
Definitely. Like malnutrition, starvation. Children who were incredibly sick because of lack of food and who needed to be hospitalized in order to be able to recover.
And so what does the operation in that case, for example, look like? I mean, you go in there with what kind of resources? Are there hospitals? Do you set up hospitals?
Sure. So we went, in this instance, we left the capital, Addis Ababa, in convoy, and we had all kinds of medicine, therapeutic food, Plumpy Nut. It's a product that we use that's a ready-to-eat food for specifically for these kind of emergencies.
What is it, like little bars, like what we would have, granola bars?
It's more like a sachet, and it's a plant protein peanut based food that's been a revolution in the treatment of malnutrition because it's easy for mothers to administer at home. Children really like it, and you just need water with it, so it doesn't need a lot of preparation.
So it's a dry thing that you mix with water?
No, you drink water with it.
Okay.
But it's a paste. I think of it sometimes like the energy gels that marathoners use.
Oh, okay.
Now, so you can just tear it open and kids can start eating it right away.
And it's very high in calories and nutrition.
High in calories and high in nutrition, yeah.
So you would bring people these.
So so the way that it worked is we went in, we liaised with the local authorities, and then we spread the word that we were there to treat malnutrition, which there was a lot of in the community. So then we started seeing patients regularly, screening them, and then figuring out what level of care they needed. So some children were treated at home by their mothers with the Plumpy Nut, with the ready-to-use food, and other children who were sicker or possibly had some other underlying health issue were then hospitalized so that they could have supervised care.
Now, when you go in there, I'm just trying to imagine, like, being in your position. Here you are, what, Americans and Europeans mostly?
Americans, Europeans, and then a lot of African colleagues as well, expats from other countries. We had some staff from Niger, Uganda, and Liberia with us as well, who are expats like we are.
And so you then go into this country, you liaise with the local authorities. Have the local authorities requested your presence in the first place? I mean, what is that relationship like?
Generally, it works where there's an agreement with the national level, and then of course, then we link in with the local authorities. Yeah, that's how we did it in Ethiopia.
And so then, how long do you stay, and at what point do you decide that the emergency is over, the crisis is over?
So it really varies. Sometimes we're working in HIV, and those kind of programs go on for a long time. Regarding the food emergency in Ethiopia, we stayed for 6 months. And the reason that we decided that the program was over, or actually we handed it over because it was so small back to the local authorities, was that we had fewer and fewer patients. But then we also did a food security survey. So epidemiologists came from the capital, and we went around for about a week and did surveys with the local community. We went out into people's field to see what was growing, and based on all the data collected, we were able to determine that in the area where we were working that people were okay and it was time to wrap the program up. But as an organization, we're still working in 5 different regions of Ethiopia, so the work continues.
So in that particular case, the plants were growing in the field. There was neither a drought nor a flood. There's presumably going to be a harvest, and you can go home.
Yeah, and we didn't have that many patients any longer. So we'd been able to the emergency had ended, in fact. Yeah.
Now, the doctors who work with Doctors Without Borders, are they volunteers? Is it part of a large permanent paid staff? How does that work?
So the first year working with the organization, you're working for a stipend, but then afterwards, some people who continue with the organization for a while and want to be part of a permanent staff, they do earn a small salary. Yeah.
Yeah. And where do the doctors come from? What are they like? What motivates them to do this kind of work? It seems like a particular calling.
Sure. We have doctors who work with us from all over the world, and I think the motivation is to be able to do this kind of service work and to help populations in need. And it's a great and very diverse group.
When you are there, do you make friends with local people? I mean, what is your own life like when you're on the ground, let's say for 6 months in Ethiopia?
Sure. So we always are. First of all, in all of our projects, 9 out of every 10 staff who work for the organization are local, national staff, people who've been hired, and they're a great link with the local community. But then living in these villages, you do get to know your neighbors and the people who run the restaurants and people you meet in the street, especially in a very small village. We quickly get to know everyone and to be a part of the community. That's part of what makes this work great. Yeah. And then you know your colleagues and counterparts in the health center and with other organizations as well. So it's a wonderful experience to live in these different villages and different places around the world.
I would think there would be, when a group like Doctors Without Borders goes into a new place, a need for cultural training, cultural sensitivity of some kind, because, I mean, every every place has its taboos or its ways of doing things, and it would, I would think, be easy to make real mistakes if you were not trained in that or aware of what's going on in the area that you're in.
We're briefed before we go about the political situation, the cultural context, and anything that's particular to an area where we might work. And then when we arrive, the national staff who we work with is always, they're great interlocutors with the local population and how to be sensitive and how to fit in, and we really go to great lengths to be to fit in where we are.
And so, in, for example, Ethiopia, what would somebody need to know?
In Ethiopia, I think you would need to know that it's a Coptic calendar, so there's a different system of time. When we arrived there, the first time that I worked in Ethiopia, for us it was 2008, and there they just celebrated the millennium. So it was the year 2000.
Right.
And then the day starts at 1 a.m. Ethiopian, which is 6 a.m. for us. So when I arrived, I asked the staff to come to work at 6, in spite of having been briefed about the time season. It was just force of habit, and so everyone did come to work at 6, which was afternoon.
Ah,
so, right. Yeah, which was my fault entirely. But all kinds of that's an important thing to know when you're in Ethiopia. Another thing in Ethiopia, I think, is about the coffee ceremony. That coffee is an important part of the very traditional life there. We were invited to some beautiful coffee ceremonies. And it's an honor to be invited, and you take your time when you're drinking coffee and when you're asked to do that. So that was something that we learned about. And just different festivals and holidays that are important there. And
We're talking to Suzanne Ceresco of Doctors Without Borders. Now, you've been in many countries: Nigeria, Sri Lanka, Malawi, Laos, South Sudan, Republic of Congo, Syria. Some of these places are, I would think, at moments pretty scary. Did you ever encounter, were there any scary or dangerous moments for you working with Doctors Without Borders?
I wouldn't say scary or dangerous, but it's certainly, I've worked in a number of places with complex security. South Sudan, certainly, there's a lot of conflict there, internal and external. And then everyone, of course, knows Syria is a very difficult place to work. I'm very well trained by the organization to work in those different kind of situations. But in Syria, because it is such a complex emergency, we had to be incredibly vigilant all the time and really work closely with our local staff to understand the context there.
How did you stay safe in Syria?
What keeps us safe in all these countries is our work with the population, our acceptance by the population, and then the quality and consistency of our medical care. So in any kind of complex emergency or complex security situation, we're accepted by the population, and it's that acceptance of the population that keeps us safe. Certainly what also keeps us safe is that there are no weapons allowed in our medical facilities, of course. So we're a very independent, very neutral organization, and we are communicating that all the time.
You've been doing this work for a while. What would you say is your most kind of vivid memory or experience of doing this work with Doctors Without Borders?
Oh, there's so many, but one thing that's always really stuck with me is working in Yida refugee camp.
Where's that?
So that's in South Sudan, on the border with Sudan, and we were working there in the rainy season in 2012, and we had tens of thousands of refugees coming across the border because they were fleeing their homes in the Nuba Mountains, where they'd been under regular aerial bombardments, and they hadn't been able to farm either. So people don't usually move during the rainy season, but in this case, the refugees got up, the Nuba people got up and came across the border, and they arrived in our camp, and the children were really in rough conditions, and we started a measles vaccination campaign, and we had set up sites throughout the camp, and during the afternoons, it would start raining, so we would stop vaccinating for the 20 minutes or so of these rain showers, and everyone would come under our shelter to get out of the rain. And it was on an afternoon like this, during the afternoon rain shower, that we had a sudden and unexpected crack of thunder. And every single child under the shelter just ducked and covered and dove right into the mud. And that really affected me because it made me understand what their childhood was like on the other side of the border and how traumatized they were, that that this was part of their daily reality on the other side.
Was there, I mean, does Doctors Without Borders work at all in mental health, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we do in a number of countries.
And so in a case like that, what, how do you respond? Are there trauma specialists?
Well, in that case, we started, we had to deal with immediate issues like food and water.
Yeah.
But in those kind of situations where there is mental health care needs to be addressed, we have a team who comes in and sets up different kinds of programs, and they're specialized in working with children if that's what the need is. In Sri Lanka, we did that after the end of the civil war there, or with adults as well. So depending on what the assessment shows, we're able to provide that kind of mental health support.
So what is next for you, Suzanne? You are a field worker with Doctors Without Borders. You're here speaking in Santa Fe tonight from 6 to 8 at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. What do you do next? Are you going to be placed in another country?
I am this summer going to go somewhere. I don't know where yet. We'll see. We'll see what the needs are. But I'm looking forward to being back in the field and rejoining the work with my colleagues.
Doctors Without Borders is on the web at doctorswithoutborders.org, and you can check out doctorswithoutborders.org/MSF on the road to find out more about the kind of work that you're doing going
from city to city. And click on Santa Fe to RSVP for the event at the Center for Contemporary Arts.
Okay, so if somebody wants to go to the event tonight, they should RSVP at that website. The number for the Center for Contemporary Arts is 505-982-1338, and they're on the web at ccasantafe.org. Suzanne, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.